Welcome, listeners, to episode 30 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Sam Adler Bell, one of the podcast co-hosts, and I'm not here with my wonderful, incredible, brilliant friend, Matthew Sittman, because right now he's busy with his real grown-up person job. That being said, don't worry. You'll hear his dulcet tones very soon when we get to the interview we recorded for this episode, which is with Nicole Hemmer, the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. And what we're talking about is something that a lot of you have probably been hoping for, expecting. We're talking about the late, great to some, Rush Limbaugh, the right-wing talk radio broadcaster who, it comes out in the conversation, we all tend to agree has had an enormous, incomparable impact on the shape of conservative politics, the nature of the Republican Party, the nature of conservative media, Fox News, and perhaps most importantly, on the presidency of our first entertainer-in-chief, Donald J. Trump. As you all probably know, Rush Limbaugh died last month. He was 70 years old, but for over 30 years, he hosted an extremely popular talk radio show. It was 3 hours every weekday, and it was basically just high-octane, unadulterated, conservative id streaming directly into the ears and minds and hearts of the conservative base. Now, Nicole Hemmer was an ideal guest to be our guide to the world of Rush, not only because she's a historian of conservative media, but because she's also writing a new book about the post-Reagan years and the effect of figures like Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich on the transformation of conservative politics in the Republican Party in the 1990s. At the moment, she's also an associate research scholar with the Obama Presidency Oral History Project at Columbia University, and she also co-hosts her own podcast, two of them, one called Past Present and the other This Day in Esoteric Political History. And before we get to the interview, I'll do our housekeeping. As always, we want to thank Dissent Magazine for sponsoring the podcast. And as many of you may know, if you sign up on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/knowyourenemy, for $10 a month, you can get access not only to our full archive of bonus episodes, which we put out every 2 weeks, you can get a free digital subscription to Dissent Magazine. For $5 a month, you get access to the full bonus archive, but no subscription to Dissent. We also want to thank our producer, Jesse Brenneman, and the person responsible for our music, Will Epstein, who records under the moniker High Space Water. Finally, please remember to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. That helps our fragile egos and helps people find the podcast who haven't heard it before. And before we get to the interview, I want to make one small correction. There's a brief discussion in here of an op-ed that Bill Buckley wrote for the New York Times, in which, horrifically, he advocated forcing men with AIDS to get tattoos, signaling their status. That's all correct. But I want to note that the quote from Dante does not actually appear in the New York Times op-ed. That was a suggestion from National Review senior editor Jeffrey Hart. This will all make sense when you get to that point in the podcast. Now, with that perhaps bewildering point made, please enjoy our interview with Nicole Hemmer about the life, the legacy, and the destructive impact, really, of Rush Limbaugh on American politics and American media.
All right, Nicole Hemmer, welcome to Know Your Enemy. It's so good to have you on, Nikki.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
We asked you on to kind of evaluate Rush Limbaugh on the occasion of his death. And since you've written about Rush in your book, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, when we reached out to you, we did so somewhat apologetically because we suspected you've been asked to weigh in on Rush quite a bit lately.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly was that week there after he died that people were really like, oh yeah, we've been talking a lot about Fox News, but there's this whole other conservative media thing over here that Rush Limbaugh's been doing for a third of a century. Maybe we should talk about that for a bit.
It's kind of incredible that, like, despite us kind of internalizing, okay, yeah, right-wing talk radio, it's so important, but just it not being, like, ambiently a part of the media environment that liberals experience,
you still forget about it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I think part of it, you know, it doesn't have the flash that television has. And it's harder to capture. I mean, until recently, when they started releasing the shows as podcasts, if you weren't tuned in, yep, you know, it was really hard to catch. It was almost impossible to get transcripts of. So unless you were willing to soak in it for hours a day, you were going to miss a lot of what conservatives imbibe when they listen to talk radio.
It's interesting. I was looking up, you know, when Rush died on, I guess it was February 17th at the age of 70 from lung cancer. You know, one of the really odious things he had done on his talk radio show was list the names of gay men who had died of AIDS, right? And that was actually, Snopes investigated it. And as you're pointing out, they couldn't find transcripts. All they could find were kind of local contemporaneous articles about him doing that. So you're right. It was very hard to go back and kind of fully investigate all the horrible things he's said over the years.
And we'll probably do some kind of, you know, lightning round of the worst things that Rush said at some point in here. But that AIDS thing, he only did it for a few weeks, and it was called right. The AIDS Update. But it was clearly like a joking, celebratory moment, because they would play songs over it, like the song I Know I'll Never Love This Way Again, or Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places, while talking about gay men dying of AIDS. But it's notable that it's one of the only things that I came across in researching for this episode that he apologized for pretty effusively. He said, quote, "It was one of the most regretful things I've ever done. And because it was, quote, making fun of people who were dying long, painful and excruciating deaths," which to Rush's very small credit, he did admit that this deeply, deeply inhumane, disgusting thing was something he did once apologize for.
Yeah, it is his rare apology. And we should also say, like, in the 1980s, on the right, the cruelty around AIDS and the joking about it and the calls for gay concentration camps and for gay men to be tattooed with their HIV status.
Buckley, right?
Yeah.
In the New York Times.
In the New York Times and Pat Buchanan. And I think that it was an incredibly cruel and inhumane moment. And also, I think, points out that there wasn't that much room between somebody like Rush Limbaugh and Bill Buckley, even though they're often kept very separate in the way we talk about the conservative movement.
We did an episode, it was a bonus episode, where we talked about Buckley and Vidal. And we ended it with that discussion of that terrible New York Times op-ed where he said that gay men should be tattooed with the phrase, what is it, Matt?
It's from Dante, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." Have that tattooed above their asses. Yeah.
And it really, I mean, we'll horrible. Get to this, I imagine, but it's one of those things where you see the right's assiduous efforts to sort of quarantine its high-minded intellectual echelon from its talk radio id is just, it's bullshit in a lot of instances.
Well, that's something we should get to. But maybe, Nikki, to start, your assessment of Rush, how important was he to conservative politics in the last 30 or 40 years?
You know, it's actually hard to find a more important figure in the conservative movement in the post-Reagan era. He really loomed so large, not just in the media world, and he more or less creates this genre of conservative talk radio, certainly is the first to make it a national phenomenon and something that is immensely profitable and popular. But he really is forging a connection between conservative media and the Republican Party in a way that, you know, conservative media, first Rush and then later Fox News, become kind of the place where you go to kiss the ring before you run for president as a Republican. And Rush Limbaugh is the one who gives conservative media that kind of power. And so you see both conservative media and the Republican Party really bend around Rush Limbaugh starting in the early 1990s, but then really continuing on for 30 years. And that's That's really important for culture, for society, for politics. So you have to put him really high up there in terms of people who are shaping what conservatism was and what it would become.
Why did he have that influence? Why did the Republican Party bend around him in some ways, as you put it? Was it just the sheer scale of his audience? Was it who was listening? Like, what was the source of that influence? Because it doesn't have to necessarily be that way.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think it was a combination of both him as this unprecedented phenomenon and then a matter of timing. So he goes on air as a nationally syndicated show in 1988. And it's in the early 1990s that he really does become this kind of media juggernaut. He has millions of listeners. He's about to start his own television show that Roger Ailes is going to produce. He has two best-selling books. And he's this multi-platform powerhouse. And the thing about the Republican Party is they don't know how much power he has, but they're scared that he has a lot. And the thing that really scares them is that he, in early 1992, is saying a lot of really nice things about Pat Buchanan. And that scares the bejesus out of the Bush people, because they're like, we don't know if he can move enough votes to get people to stick with Buchanan or to sit out the 1992 election, and we need to win him over. And so, of course, the story that Limbaugh tells again and again is that, you know, Bush reaches out to him and he has Limbaugh and Ailes over to the White House. They stay overnight. They sit in the president's box in the 1992 convention. Like, they imbue him with all of this power. And even though both Pat Buchanan and George H.W. Bush lose, he's seen as a kingmaker and the new leader of the opposition.
Your book has the wonderful detail that George H.W. Bush carried Limbaugh's bag into the White House.
Yes. And the reason you know that is because Rush Limbaugh mentioned that story at least once a year, right? That the president carried his bags.
It's such a Trumpy thing to zero in on this emasculating moment to lord over somebody who used to be opposed to him, who's now a sycophant.
Yeah, I mean, compare it to Mitt Romney begging for Trump's endorsement in 2012. The figures and the roles there feel very much the same, with Mitt Romney as George H.W. Bush and Donald Trump as Rush Limbaugh.
Right, exactly.
Nikki, your book is called Messengers of the Right. What was Rush Limbaugh's message? I mean, I imagine a fair number of our listeners, they know who Rush is and maybe even have listened to him. I feel like most of us have been on a car ride at some point where you're going through and, you know, Rush is on because he was on 3 hours a day. So you're bound to kind of run into him. But for those who really, you know, have only read about Rush or kind of know him by reputation, what was he saying? How was it packaged? Because, I mean, he was kind of like, there would be funny parts too, right? Like funny songs or kind of bells and whistles in terms of the radio production. Like, what was he saying and how did he say it?
Yeah, I think that the how is really important here, because his conservatism was not that interesting. It was pretty much a reflection of whatever the Republican Party was saying at the time, more or less. He had a beat on the more Pat Buchanan-y wing of the party. But, you know, he was
more of a paleocon in the early 90s.
I think that actually he was more stylistically interested in Pat Buchanan less so than in the issues themselves. I think that the style question is important because Rush Limbaugh starts off not as somebody who's involved in politics. He starts off as somebody who's a radio DJ and a sports commentator. And he's actually not that interested in politics. He doesn't vote, you know, he doesn't talk about politics on air. And when he finally starts to do that, and he starts to do that in the 1980s, he's really marinating in the world of the shock jock, right? Mm-hmm. The Don Imuses and the Howard Sterns and the Morton Downey Juniors, and bringing that kind of sensibility to politics. And he can do that with conservatism, right? Because he positions conservatism, even in, you know, the waning days of the Reagan years, as this oppositional identity, right? That they're outsiders, that they're up against all of these different institutions, and that they can be irreverent and funny and entertaining and make jokes. And then he brings this real morning zoo sensibility to political chatter. You know, he does all these satirical songs. We can talk about some of those. He does all these bits. He does collar abortions. Lot of this is about kind of, outrage and shock and being entertaining.
Triggering the libs, as we would say today.
Absolutely. And I think that that's actually really important, that if he had one implacable enemy, it wasn't the Soviet Union and it wasn't anything outside of the U.S. It was liberals. And when he didn't have anything particularly interesting to say about conservatism, and again, he didn't often have that much interesting to say about conservatism, but man, did he hate liberals. And man, right. Was he ready to point out their hypocrisy and their evilness, and everything that was wrong with America could be traced back to liberalism.
That's something that always struck me about Rush in the time that I listened to him, is he incubates this kind of combination of hardcore conservatives, even socially conservative rhetoric with kind of like shocking countercultural positioned style. It's always so, like, when he's talking about feminists, or he's talking about Hillary Clinton, or he's talking about Sandra Fluke, of course, the young woman who was advocating for getting birth control pills from her university health insurance plan, that it's so lascivious and crude, right? It's lasciviousness and crudeness, and it's even titillating in pursuit of supposedly these sort of socially conservative ends. And it just seems to be so, that thing, that combination of kind of like giving conservative men in particular libidinal joys, both in terms of like animosity and pure anger towards the people that they perceive as holding them back or their enemies or women in general, and sort of like sexual titillation, mm-hmm. which just seems to be something that has stuck with conservative media and been so important to its success.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the radio version of Roger Ailes's clear desktops, so that you can see the legs of the blonde women that he hires.
Exactly.
I think that this is actually a really important point, because he does do that, right? It's both the frisson of him calling feminist feminazis, and the idea that, you know, you would call somebody a Nazi, and that sort of boundary crossing, but also right. calling women bimbos and sluts. And, yeah. you know, if he talked about a woman reporter, and he's actually said this about me on the air, like, he calls them info babes. And it does a couple of things, right? Like, it belittles the woman, but it also is just like, we're men, right? Like, we yeah. can recognize when a woman's attractive. We haven't been like whipped by feminists to be unmanned and no longer be able to recognize like these are women. And so it has that energy to it as well.
It's like you can humiliate the woman reporter or politician or whatever, which has the effect of harming her, but also the humiliation is enjoyable to his male listeners.
Exactly.
I'm just old enough, I'm in my late 30s, that I can remember like my dad watching Rush's television show in like the early 90s, mid 90s. And the only thing I remember is that during the Clinton years, every episode would begin the same way, with Rush Limbaugh saying, day 72 of America held hostage by the Clinton administration, uh-huh. basically. That was the gag at the beginning. But I just, the point about his misogyny and the way he talked about women, one of the more disgusting episodes from his television show was in 1993, so just after the Clintons had come into the White House. This was his bit. He said, Sox is the White House cat, but did you know there's also a White House dog? And he held up a photograph of Chelsea Clinton, who at the time was 13 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a kind of cruelty and like a schoolyard bullying that has that misogyny, but it's also just like, that's a kid. What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And it's like the boundary crossing, like, you know, like every time some liberal like comedy writer or something like tweeted something about Barron Trump during the Trump administration, mm-hmm. there would be a million conservatives being like, oh my God, this crosses a line. Have you no decency? Blah, 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 blah. I mean, and obviously that was totally dishonest bullshit. Didn't really care. But the thing about Rush was always that kind of boundary crossing in service of giving people this political jouissance, like just making people feel good, you know, like reactionary politics as enjoyment via boundary crossing.
Yeah, and then it has another layer too, right? The transgression is wrapped in a joke or it's wrapped in satire.
Right.
And so when he gets called out on it, he can just be like, look, you know, I'm just an entertainer here. I'm just joking. I'm just kidding around. That was satire. And so he can back himself out of the controversy by saying that people just don't understand, that they're taking him literally and not seriously.
Right.
I mean, I remember him, that was a big thing during the Obama years where he had the Barack the Magical Negro song.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the argument was like, black people are not the butt of this joke. Liberals are the butt of this joke.
Mm-hmm.
You're humorless if you don't get it.
Yeah. And then really the point of it was that transgressive thrill of continuously saying Negro on the radio.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which ties into one or two other controversies these days.
Yeah. One of the really fascinating parts of your book is kind of the distinctions you make between the first generation of conservative media figures and then a second generation that would include people like Limbaugh. But before we parse some of those differences, I wondered if you could just say a little more about his relationship to what we would consider the mainstream conservative movement. Because as you pointed to earlier, we tend to think of Rush Limbaugh as different than William F. Buckley. One's highbrow, one's lowbrow, one's on PBS with Firing Line, the other's on talk radio, so on and so forth. But, you know, Buckley called Limbaugh a friend. He spoke favorably of Limbaugh's show. And I saw, I think it was just in 2019, the National Review Institute gave Limbaugh the William F. Buckley Prize for Political Thought, I believe it was called. So what, you know, what are some of those connections between Rush and like the so-called good conservatives or the, you know, quarantined mainstream National Review conservatism that put up guardrails against extremism and kicked out the anti-Semites and racists and so on and so forth? How would you kind of describe that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of different things going on there. One is sort of his relationship to erudite conservatism, the kind of thing that you find in print media that William F. Buckley embodied. And you mentioned that they're friends. Limbaugh really desired, he really longed for acceptance from the print magazine crowd. He wanted to be seen as a serious thinker. So he wrote pieces for National Review. National Review put him on the cover in 1993 as the leader of the opposition. They would do that again in 2009, anytime a Democrat won the presidency. Rush Limbaugh would suddenly be the leader of the opposition again. I mean, they saw him as somebody who was energizing conservatism, who had tapped into the base and was able to spread the conservative gospel in a way that went down easy. So there was a real embrace of him. There wasn't a kind of looking askance at Limbaugh as something that was lowbrow, but as an interesting new phenomenon. And of course, the kind of impact that he has on conservatism and conservative media going forward, like he's not developing some new school of thought for conservative thinkers to stroke their thin chins about and philosophize. But I mean, the stylistic influence that he has, I mean, Fox News is essentially, you know, talk radio for television. Cable right. news, in fact, is largely modeled after talk radio, especially MSNBC and Fox News in 1996. And that kind of name-calling and anti-liberalism and the idea that you could be profane and that you could joke around and that you could introduce humor and entertainment and profit in the pursuit of these ideological political ends. I mean, that has become the beating heart of the conservative movement. You could call it all a grift, or you could call it just the developments within political entertainment that have influenced not only conservatism, but American politics more generally. But he gets a lot of credit for showing that there was an audience for this kind of political entertainment and helping to build and create an audience for this kind of political entertainment.
Yeah, I remember reading that, I guess there's the NR cover in 1993, and then in 1994, when the Republicans take control of the House of Representatives, they invite him to come do an introduction to the Republican freshman class, right? And he's considered an honorary member of the caucus. And that's like this full-on embrace of Rush by the new Republican hegemony in Washington at that moment.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's called the majority maker by that group. And just to add one little detail from something that I've been researching for my new book, on the opening day of the new Congress, Newt Gingrich has turned over part of his speaker's office to Rush Limbaugh. So Rush Limbaugh is broadcasting live from Newt Gingrich's speaker's office that first week that Newt Gingrich is speaker. And that's how close that relationship actually was and how vital they saw Rush Limbaugh as part of the conservative movement, now as part of the Republican Party apparatus.
I did not know that. That is fascinating.
Well, maybe we should talk a little bit about Newt, too, as kind of a comrade and counterpart in these years in the 90s. I mean, in addition to giving over part of his office to Rush to record on the day that this congressional session started, how else do those two figures interact and intersect in the 90s?
Well, I think it's important to think of them as sometimes complementary and sometimes competing sort of silos of power, right? Because if you're calling Rush Limbaugh the leader of the opposition, the actual leader of the opposition is not going to take too kindly to that.
Right.
So there is a bit of a rivalry there. But if you think about the importance of rhetoric, the importance of demonizing liberals, the importance of Bill Clinton as kind of the antichrist figure in conservatism in the 1990s. I mean, that's so important to both of them. And, you know, Gingrich is somebody who is kind of obsessed with language. He is really trying to fine tune it in order to both build his majority, but also to win political arguments and win political power. And that focus on language and rhetoric and arguments, I think that is of a piece with a lot of what Limbaugh is doing as well. I'm not going to say that Gingrich was as entertaining as Rush Limbaugh, but he was somebody who sought out controversy and he saw politics as a battle, right? He didn't believe that you were there to make friends. He wasn't there to make friends. He was there to tear it all down. And that kind of radicalism, I think, runs through both men.
I mean, you can't expect a trained historian and professor like Gingrich to, match Limbaugh in terms of the entertainment.
Fair enough.
One thing I was thinking about when we were sort of talking about why his show worked so well, why it appealed to people, was the idea that in addition to sort of offering this frisson of transgression and humiliating his enemies and stuff like that, was also this thing of creating this closed epistemological universe, right? That you turn on Limbaugh and there's all these references to stuff. Some of it's bits that he's had going for a while. Some of it is like scandals that only register if you're listening to him all the time or nowadays reading fringe conservative websites. It's like if you listen, you are in the know, you're getting the real truth that you're not going to hear elsewhere. Like there's all these elements of creating this closed space that obviously now we're all very concerned about, kind of these epistemological silos and polarization and stuff like that. But it does seem like he created or sort of started to blueprint this kind of conservative media where you listen and you get the secret knowledge. And there's not going to be any kind of countervailing argument heard. You know, you're just going to get the pure stuff.
Yeah, I would say that is the pitch and the appeal of conservative media for a long time before Limbaugh. And then Limbaugh does it as well, which is we're going to tell you the things that they won't tell you. We're going to say the things that they won't let you say. And the combination of those two things both creates a kind of safe space and an access to secret knowledge that becomes really important to the conservative political identity, right? Part of being a conservative is consuming this secret knowledge, right? Having the scales fall off your eyes. Now I think we say you've been red-pilled, right? You've
right.
You're able to see the world as it is, not as You've been brainwashed by the liberals to believe it to be. And so that idea of secret knowledge is really, really important. And the epistemology of it and that sense of a closed universe where the references are all to other points in that universe, right? Rest. So it sounds like you're reading this like extremely well-researched piece, or that you're hearing that, you know, all this evidence is coming in, and it's coming in from National Review and the Weekly Standard and Fox News. And so the you have all these reference points to books and experts and shows, and it's all people who are part of the same political project. But it creates a whole network of authorities that give it a feeling of weight and of groundedness and of evidence.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, too, some of the like mockery he engages in, like he called Michelle Obama moochow, like mooch, like a smooch, I guess, or smoochow, something like that, a kind of derisive, kind of sexualized nickname for her. I mean, that's part of the cinematic universe, right? You have like heroes and villains. You have the feminazis and the libs. And I think that ability to just kind of construct a parallel universe where everything within it makes sense is, as you're getting at, Nikki, like, I think it's very constitutive of like a thick conservative political identity.
Absolutely.
Like your fellow conservatives all get the same references. You all kind of inhabit this shared bizarro world.
And a shared kind of lingo and set of references that makes sense only to you. So he used to call Robert Byrd Sheets. He used to call Ted Kennedy the swimmer because of Chappaquiddick. It's not great, guys.
Wow.
He would have all of these references, and he would expect his audience to understand them. And then they would take those references out into the world. And it created a situation where, you know, there was this moment in, I think it was 2014, where Bill O'Reilly, when he was still on Fox News, was interviewing President Obama. And he was making all of these references that, if you were not steeped in the day-to-day Benghazi scandalization that was happening on conservative talk radio and Fox News, you would not have understood a single question that he was asking. And that's the end result and the consequence of having that closed system of references, is that you've developed a whole language and a kind of shorthand for talking about politics and scandal and conspiracies that your audience understands well, but just it doesn't make any sense to people who are not part of that media environment.
And the effects of that on kind of like, you know, our public square and sort of functioning of our democracy, we can see very clearly today. But I would just say for the listeners, if this hasn't sort of clicked, the reason that that works so well is that that's actually how so many kind of internally coherent media environments works, like fandoms. Like, I remember recently I was like, I didn't know what WandaVision was. This is a new like Marvel Cinematic Universe show. And I was looking at a tweet. I retweeted somebody saying something like, what is WandaVision? And then somebody responded like, well, you'd have to watch like these 8 movies in order to understand basically what's going on in this show. And so that's very alienating and ridiculous to me. But for people who are in that, it feels so good to catch every reference, to know what's happening, to sort of to capture the sort of like underlying, you know, the little fan service-y kind of notes that make you feel like I'm part of a community, I'm part of a sort of a shared hidden knowledge here, makes you feel good. It makes you feel like seen and part of a community. And of course that works.
I think that's so important to underscore, because that sense of belonging is such a powerful political value. And Rush Limbaugh cultivated that very early on. I mean, part of it is inherent in the medium itself. I mean, unlike Fox News, you could pick up the phone and you could call in to the Rush Limbaugh show. You could hear him talking to ordinary people just like you. And it had that feeling of interactivity in a pre-internet or proto-internet era that just people hadn't experienced much like that before. And they would get together and they would have these rush rooms in local restaurants where people would gather while the show was playing so they could all listen together. And so the embodiment of that community, that you could actually sit there with other Ditto heads and listen to this program, there's a real power in that. And there's a political development in that that I think people would do well to study and understand.
Hey, what do you want to do for lunch? Hey, do you want to go down to the rush room at so-and-so and like, you know, have your eat a salad while you listen? I guess they'd play it over like the speakers and everyone would just sit there eating and listening and talking quietly among themselves.
Laughing at the jokes.
That's just kind of amazing. I just couldn't believe it.
Well, the same thing, the same kind of sort of parasocial relationship forms around podcasts, we should acknowledge. People are, I mean, I think we don't have to go too far down this path, but like Rush also, I think, is so important to the DNA of this medium. Like, that this kind of thing that like I'm talking directly to you and it's intimate and you know all the references and like, you know, people like form fandoms around podcasts and then get together in person and talk about the podcast. They create subreddits about the podcast and all the sort of like references. They created like a key so you can understand everything that's happened on the show in the past. It's just, it's very similar. I mean, our podcast is kind of you know, wimpy and and like we don't sound much like Rush, but there are definitely podcasts on the left that make you feel good in the same way of like make you fun of our shared enemies and, you know, have a kind of like drive time AM radio quality. We owe Rush too. We're indebted to Rush, I guess.
Well, for certainly understanding the importance of the intimacy of the medium, I think intimacy is such an important word there because there is a, what we see with podcast audiences is that they are fiercely loyal and that the way that knowledge of podcasts spreads is through word of mouth. Right. People get so into it that they tell their friends about it. And that same dynamic is part of how the Rush Limbaugh audience grew. People were really excited about it and they told their friends about it and they wanted people to listen to it. And they felt a real personal connection. I mean, if you tuned in to the Limbaugh show in the few weeks now since he's died, it's people calling in and sobbing because they feel like they've lost a father figure. Or they feel like they've lost a friend because he was their constant companion 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for 32 years.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, Nikki, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and this relates to your book, Messengers of the Right, which is about conservative media. Limbaugh didn't come from nowhere. I mean, you know, he's a part of a broader story that you can tell, a story you did tell in your book. And one of the key features of Limbaugh's rise and kind of how we think about the conservative media, especially the rise of conservative media in the last few decades, has been the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine in 1987. Because under the Reagan administration, the Fairness Doctrine is repealed or changed. And then in 1988, that's when Limbaugh gets his first nationally syndicated radio contract. But one of the things your book points out is that their proximity might lead people to think the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine was more important to Limbaugh and his success than maybe it was. But could you just talk about what the Fairness Doctrine was and what its repeal meant?
Sure. So the Fairness Doctrine was a regulation that was put in place by the Federal Communications Commission in 1949. And the basic idea behind it was, you know, there had been a ban on opinion broadcasting for a good 10 years at that point. It was called the Mayflower Doctrine. And it came from this real fear that radio stations were going to use the airwaves for propaganda. And you can imagine why in the early 1940s they were a little worried about propaganda coming from the radios. So this was their way of saying, okay, we've licensed your radio station. We've given you this public resource, the airwaves, and the exclusive use of them. And in return, you have an obligation to the public. And your obligation to the public is this. You have to cover controversial issues. You can't just ignore them. And you have to cover them fairly. You can't just air one side of an issue. You've got to give people the debate so that they can engage in political discussion in a fair way and that they can understand it. And this was a doctrine that wasn't always enforced very heavily, but it was useful sometimes in the U.S. South during the civil rights era, where there were obviously some really egregious violations by white Southerners who refused to cover fairly the civil rights movement. In fact, were excluding coverage of the civil rights movement from television broadcasts. So there was a role for it to play there. Conservatives saw this as a muzzle of sorts. They saw this as the federal government coming in and saying, every time a conservative speaks, a liberal must speak. But nobody is paying attention to the fact that every news broadcast is actually biased towards liberalism. So the argument there was, you know, all the media is biased towards liberalism, but it's only when a conservative says something that people start screaming about the fairness doctrine and the need for balance. So they didn't like the fairness doctrine very much and were eager to remove it. It was a useful boogeyman. They used it to raise a lot of money, calling censorship. Mm-hmm. But by the 1970s, there are a number of conservatives who start to see a possibility in the fairness doctrine. They're like, wait a second. If liberals can come and demand airtime because of something a conservative says, well, this would be a great way to get more conservative voices on other stations. Like, we should start suing PBS so that they'll cover conservative viewpoints in addition to liberal viewpoints. So you have folks like Phyllis Schlafly and Pat Buchanan, and in fact, Newt Gingrich, who are arguing in the 1980s to keep the fairness doctrine in place. Reagan gets rid of it through his FCC as part of his overall deregulation binge during the 1980s. But there's a real fight over the next few years by conservatives as well as liberals to have the fairness doctrine put back in place. It's only when Rush Limbaugh becomes this national phenomenon that they realize, oh, we don't need the fairness doctrine. We've got Rush Limbaugh and we're doing just fine without the fairness doctrine.
Yeah. No, that was the part of your book that I really it was illuminating for me, because I imagined a more broad-based conservative resistance to the fairness doctrine. But it totally makes sense to think that you could actually wield it against liberals for the reasons you're saying. One question I had for you about that, just when you talk about giving equal time or treating things fairly, or, you know, a conservative speaks, you have to have a liberal speak, would that be like in one show? Or would it be you could have a conservative show and then a liberal show? What was kind of practically what that would have meant?
Yeah, I mean, it would be easier to explain if the FCC had ever come up with a real set of guidelines for what any of this meant.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But I mean, they just were like, you have to be fair. And when somebody files a fairness doctrine complaint, we'll look at it and then you get a chance to respond. And if you're like, well, we did everything we could to air both sides, then they basically let you get away with whatever. I mean, it could mean something like, I'll use an example from the Nixon administration. I think it was PBS. One of the networks ran a documentary called The Selling of the Pentagon, and it had to do with, selling Americans on pro-military propaganda. And it looked at all of the money that they had given to PR firms to do this. And the Department of Defense didn't think that they were treated very fairly. And so they filed a fairness doctrine complaint. And what ended up happening was that the network went back and they did some interviews, which they both included in the documentary and that they aired later on. They aired a special where the two sides debated. So that's one way that it could happen, right? You could have the opposition or the person filing the fairness doctrine complaint come on and tell their side of the story. But how it actually worked in practice often was it was an excuse for stations not to run incendiary content. It was something that they would use not to run union radio shows. It was something that they would use sometimes not to run conservative radio shows, because somebody like the broadcaster I write about, Clarence Mannion, he swore up front. He was like, I am never going to have a liberal on my show, right? This is conservative radio here. And, you know, if you were a station worried about the fairness doctrine, you might not want to run that show because you would potentially have to give free airtime to liberals who challenged what he said. The caveat here, and the why I'm hesitant to say, oh, look, they got rid of the fairness doctrine and then came along Rush Limbaugh. Ergo, the fairness doctrine was standing in the way of Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh had been on air doing his show in Sacramento for 4 years before he went national. There were people like Morton Downey Jr. and Bob Grant who were doing local conservative shtick, pretty unfair and sometimes pretty racist programming. And the Fairness Doctrine didn't do jack to them. So it's really hard to say that the Fairness Doctrine was this kind of muzzle when it actually wasn't muzzling that many people. I think that it's much more important that you had, you know, the rise of FM, which opened up the AM dial, that you had the rise of satellite and toll-free calling that made it possible technologically to have a nationally syndicated call-in show like this that could be simulcast around the country. It's I would not put it all on the Fairness Doctrine.
Well, so if there's a kind of like sort of historical trajectory of Limbaugh, we have kind of the ascendance in the 90s to this position of just extraordinary prominence and coming to be seen as a power broker in the party. Everybody has to kiss the ring. You know, this sort of tension, but also cooperation between him and Newt Gingrich during the Clinton years, sort of treating the Clintons as this just terrible enemy, like as Matt referenced, kind of holding the country hostage. Hillary Clinton, of course, we should acknowledge, just one of his perennial bete noirs, just anytime he can go after Hillary, it's red meat to his audience, and he seems to relish it himself. I mean, I'm not as familiar with what role he played in the Bush years. Did he tend to be kind of just a cheerleader for the administration? Did he have some of the criticisms that some conservatives had of some of the sort of big government tendencies of Bush? Or, as I might imagine, just like with the post 9/11 stuff, it was pretty easy for the conservatives to just coalesce around being cheerleaders for the war on terror and demonizing Muslims in the country. What was sort of Rush's attitude during the Bush years?
Well, during the Bush years, he was facing for the first time actual competition. I mean, not only is that the period in which Fox News takes off, but in that period between 2000 and 2002, that's when all of the big competitors start to show up. So people like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, Michael Savage, Laura Ingraham, they all get their shows in that same period. And many of them, I mean, somebody like Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity's very first radio show was September 10th, 2001.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
You can imagine how this fed into his sense of, I have been put here for a reason, right? My purpose is to help shepherd the country through this this dark time. So it's definitely the case that during the early years of the war on terror, conservative media is broadly speaking real cheerleaders for George W. Bush.
Frankly, so is liberal media.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the outliers here are people like, you know, Pat Buchanan, who gets his MSNBC gig in 2002 because he's like one of the lone conservatives out there who's saying that the war is a bad idea, even though for very different reasons than I think most liberal opponents to it were. But, you know, there is that period going into the end of the Bush administration where Bush's support is collapsing. And, you know, there are more criticisms coming from Limbaugh and from other parts of conservative media during that period, particularly around things like immigration. At least some of the hosts have picked up on the fact that the base is not as interested in immigration reform as Bush was.
Right.
And in general, like trying to figure out how are we going to pick up the pieces after this is all over, because, you know, those last few years of the Bush administration, it had really bottomed out. Now, the complicating factor for Limbaugh was that he was actually friends to a certain extent with George W. Bush. And, you know, Bush would call into his radio program just as his father appeared on the radio program back in 1992. So Limbaugh doesn't ever really abandon Bush, but he does take the opportunity to sort of find his inner deficit hawk and his inner immigration hawk during that period when Bush is becoming less and less popular. Because as the base abandons Bush, Limbaugh begins to abandon Bush. And they're all rescued, of course, by the arrival of the first black president.
Yeah, I was about to say. They really found their footing again with the Obama years.
Yeah, no kidding.
I did not realize that Hannity's show had started just literally the day before 9/11. But I have to, when I was a young conservative driving to and from college, I went to a conservative Christian college. I'd be driving home for the weekend and I'd have talk radio on, and it might be Hannity, it might be Limbaugh. But Hannity's show, I think, might have permanently ruined that great Martina McBride song, Independence Day.
Oh, I know.
Because it always was the beginning of a show. And it's kind of this patriotic country song references Independence Day. And it's a great song, but it's inextricably connected to Hannity in my mind now.
Well, one thing about Sean Hannity is he never sees a dead horse that he can't hit a little bit more. The man is pretty repetitive. So he's not going to like switch out that bumper music. You're just going to hear Independence Day probably like 20 times per broadcast.
Oh,
for sure.
I know.
We've already sort of referenced some of Limbaugh's attitude towards the Obama years, and just sort of racial dog whistling would be a kind way to describe it. And also like a lot of vitriol against Michelle Obama as well. I was noting as I was looking through this history, the moment in 2009 when Michael Steele, who was the black head of the Republican National Committee, sort of vaguely criticized Limbaugh because the Democrats were at that moment trying to brand the Republicans as the party of Limbaugh. And in response to that, Michael Steele said something like, you know, Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer. His whole thing is entertainment. He's incendiary. And he said, yes, it's ugly. He said that on CNN. There was a huge backlash. And then Michael Steele apologized to Rush Limbaugh, right? He went on and said, he went on to say, you know, my intent was not to go after Rush. I have enormous respect for Rush Limbaugh. He said he is, you know, a very valuable conservative voice for our party. It was not an attempt on my part to diminish his voice or his leadership. You know, if anybody's offended, I'm so sorry. I'm not, you know, it was, I mean, it was really the amount, the level of obsequiousness that was required of him in order to, you know, like shore up his conservative bona fides in that moment. It was really remarkable.
It really is. I mean, there are a couple parts of that story. I mean, one reason why Democrats started to brand the Republican Party the party of Limbaugh is that a poll was taken in early 2009 that said, who leads the Republican Party? And the answer that came in at the top was no one. But after no one was Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
And, you know, John McCain had tried to paint the party as, you know, more of a reform party and with something for everyone, you know, that wasn't the kind of caricature of cruel conservatism. And
right.
So here was this opportunity to say, well, kind of is. But I think that that's actually such an important and telling moment in terms of presaging what would happen with Donald Trump. I mean, that kind of obsequiousness and that display of loyalty is something that we saw throughout the Trump administration. But that idea of a cult of personality and of someone who you could not cross existed before Trump ever showed up, and it existed in the person of Rush Limbaugh. And that moment has also always been one that I point to when people ask whether there's a liberal counterpart to conservative media. I mean, nobody is apologizing to Rachel Maddow for saying unkind things about her, right? They're not calling up Chapo Trap House or Pod Save America and saying, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that I criticized you.
Yeah.
No one has that kind of influence and power in more overtly liberal media that Limbaugh has shown for just decades on the right.
Right.
Why do you think that is? I guess I'm interested in that kind of psychic connection, that feeling that at Trump's rallies, when you watch him speak, you can see the way he feeds off the crowd, right? And kind of can tell when he's giving them what they want. Like, how would you describe that connection? Because it's something when you look at it, you can see it. But why is it that, you know, one person can wield that kind of power and influence on the right? Because it's not, as you're pointing out, it's not the same on the broad liberal left in a lot of ways. And, you know, how does that work, do you think?
Yeah, I don't have a sort of total answer on this, but I think that there are parts of it that we can point to. And part of it is, you know, so much of the politics of conservatism have become the politics of resentment mm-hmm. and the politics mm-hmm. of being an outsider who's having things taken from you. And here is this powerful, wealthy person coming forward and saying, no, I have their back. No, I'm going to take uh-huh. all of the slings and arrows for you. They'll call me names, but I'm going to stand on the line and I'm going to continue to defend you and speak up for you. And that idea that you have found a kind of champion uh-huh. for your cause, somebody who sees you, somebody who will defend you, somebody who will say all those things that you're not supposed to say, is a kind of... there's a kind of loyalty that develops yeah. there, because you're not just protecting them, you're protecting yourself by protecting them. An attack on them is an attack on you. And so you react in that kind of defensive and almost existential way, right? Because if they yeah. take yeah. if they take him down, they've taken me down and they've silenced my voice and they've disempowered me, and I can't let that happen.
Yeah. Right. And I would have to imagine too, I mean, I know just as someone who was a Bernie Sanders supporter, when Bernie would really get wound up and, you know, rail against the 1% and the rigged economy. I mean, I felt that,
yeah. you know,
so I would have to imagine too, just hearing someone speak your resentments in a way, or, you know, speak about issues in a way, if you can say they speak about issues in a way, you know, that taps into the thing you feel, but were afraid to say, or just haven't heard people say before on a national level.
Yeah, you feel seen. And that is one of the most powerful political emotions that you can imagine. And of course, it isn't exclusive to conservatives. I mean, I think that it has been cultivated in a certain media environment on the right. But that idea has been a powerful force in left-wing and liberal politics for a long, long time. The idea that somebody sees you and can speak for you and can represent you and can put your issues on the table. I mean, that's why we do politics. Mm-hmm. And so there's something incredibly, incredibly powerful about that, and that the right has been very good at. Now, I would argue that they've been good at it in a very destructive way, in a way that's been yeah. destructive of democracy, particularly as we've seen it in the last several years, though I think that they've been building to that for some time.
Right.
But it is playing on a kind of fundamental political truth, which is if you make people feel like you see them, that's political power right there.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that interested me in reading your book and thinking about the relationship between conservatism and its messengers and the media was the way in which, I mean, we've sort of alluded to the ways in which Trump is really kind of like the child, the sort of progeny of Limbaugh's project. Like he really, or at least the embodiment of it in actual kind of conservative politics. In the past, you had figures who had to pay tribute to the king, to King Limbaugh, kiss his ring, and so on. In Trump, you have this figure who kind of just instinctively gets what Limbaugh does and mm-hmm. sort of channels the same thing, just kind of does the same thing as a politician. He's not a politician playing the part or running through the motions of what he needs to do in order to maintain the support of Limbaugh's audience or Limbaugh himself. He is a politician who is sort of exactly a broadcaster or exactly an entertainer, right?
Absolutely.
And I find that dynamic so fascinating, in the sense that Trump seems to be kind of the apotheosis of something that Limbaugh set in motion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a couple of parts of it. One is that, you know, remember that day in 2015, I'm sure none of us will ever forget it, when Donald Trump announced he was running for president. And that speech struck so many people as so bizarre and racist and incomprehensible. And for people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, it was a pretty understandable speech, and it was a pretty understandable speaking style. It was elliptical, it was wandering, it not only dog whistled a bunch of resentments, it just said a bunch of racist things. And his speaking style, whether it's calling people names, whether it's being racist and misogynistic and nativist, I mean, the way he spoke would have been very familiar to a Limbaugh listener. But you're right mm-hmm. that he didn't need to do the Kiss the Ring politics. And I think one place where you really see that is, you know, back in 2012, I think I write about this near the end of the book, Dick Morris was on Fox News and on Fox and Friends, and he was sitting on their big red couch. And it was right before the Iowa primaries. And he says, you don't win Iowa in Iowa. You win it here. You win it on Fox News. And that was a very defensible claim, given that two of the people who would be vying for the nomination had to resign from Fox before they ran for president, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum. But Donald Trump, although he came up through Fox News, right, he had a regular spot on Fox and Friends starting in 2011. He didn't feel any loyalty to Fox because he didn't need them as translators to the base. He could speak to the base directly, and sometimes Fox got in his way. And when Fox got in his way, he denounced Fox. And what happened? People stopped watching.
Right.
It was the most amazing thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he bent the system around him just as Limbaugh had bent the party system around himself back in the 1990s, where suddenly, Fox wasn't in the driver's seat. And none right. of these places yeah. were in the driver's seat anymore. Trump was in the driver's seat, and they had to conform themselves to his desires. And it continues to be a really remarkable thing to watch.
And it's interesting to think, too, that Trump, you know, would go on Howard Stern, would go on Larry mm-hmm. King, you know, the kind of medium that Limbaugh pioneered. Like, you know, Trump was in that world, too.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's actually really important. I mean, one of the things that I focus on in my next book is the role of non-conservative media in creating conservative entertainment. So shows like Politically Incorrect, shows like Howard Stern, shows like Larry King, they're all doing the same kind of political entertainment. And then also just a little bit of like political reality television in a way, right? It's like where you're getting like a little peek behind the curtain of a lot of these people. And then, of course, Trump himself would go on to forge his national identity through reality television. But he was very much on the beat of the media moment, right? Larry King Live was one of the biggest shows when it started going on air in the mid-1980s. Howard Stern was this place where you just reached a different audience. You reached an audience that wasn't necessarily tapped into politics. And one of the things that Trump seems to have understood is that he's got the Fox News base, right? He's got Rush Limbaugh's base. What he needed was a base that was outside of that as well. And he did a pretty good job. In both the 2016 and 2020 race of tapping into those unactivated political demographics.
Right.
In any of your research, did you come across the clip of Trump on Larry King Live? It's the one where he says, Larry, your breath is horrible. Do you mind if I sit back a little bit? He kept talking about how horrible Larry King's breath was.
Jesus
and how he, and how he was like not going to lean into the mic, you know, like across the table, and he was going to like lean back. It was just so bizarre.
He's such a weirdo, man.
I have not seen that, but that is very, I feel like this dropped out once Trump became president. But, you know, he was germophobic. He's also, like, not nice. That never yeah. dropped out of the conversation. But, like, he didn't defer to anyone. Yeah. And that's the power play that he's doing there, right? Larry King is the guy you're supposed to defer to, but he goes on his show and he tells him he has bad breath and he mocks him. And that's his power play.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One thing that strikes me about this whole conversation is that there's a particular kind of relationship that conservatism has had to its media supporters and the people in the media who have either kind of shaped it or lifted it up or helped the political ambitions of people who have been involved with it, which doesn't really have an analog in the 20th century on the left, as far as I can tell. You know, it's so fascinating that, like, the National Review, I mean, to go all the way back, like the National Review played such a role in sort of like cohering what it was that American conservatism would be. But then, of course, like somebody like Rush Limbaugh, he's not just a political pundit or entertainer. He's also a political power broker within the party. I mean, even Pat Buchanan is a media figure, right? As much as he mm-hmm. is a politician, he has his association with the American conservative. And he's also on TV, you know, he's on Crossfire, he's doing all this stuff. And I guess my question is, is there something, and I know as a historian, you're probably not going to want to say across time, it's always the same, but like, is there something about conservatism as a project in American politics that means that it needs or kind of has a more symbiotic or even parasitic relationship with media platforms and media figures that distinguishes it from the Democrats or the liberal project?
You know, I don't think that it's a requirement, right? I don't think that there is something inherent in conservatism that determined this particular type of relationship with media. I think that there were conservatives in the 1940s and 50s who felt shut out of the media conversation and came to believe that control of communications meant control of politics. And so if they wanted to have political power, that political power ran through media operations. And that then begins to set into motion the development of a conservative movement that has media figures at its very center. Because they were activists, they were not just publishing a magazine. You know, in the case of National Review, they were holding protests against Khrushchev's visits. They were founding Young Americans for Freedom so that there would be a presence on college campuses. They were helping to organize in 1960 and 1964 the Draft Goldwater campaigns. Right. They were intimately involved in Republican Party politics, in activism and organizing, and in messaging for the right. And so you have right at the heart of the modern conservative project this idea that how you do politics is at least partially through media.
Right.
That you have this liberal bias critique that is part of what it means to be a conservative in the United States. And all of that predates Rush Limbaugh by decades. So by the time that Rush Limbaugh rolls around, part of what it means to be a conservative is to consume alternative media. So he has, I mean, he does something special with his audience, but they are primed for this. And so you see it develop onward from there. But I don't think that it's determined by conservatism as an ideology. I think that it's historically set into motion by a set of decisions that people made in the 1940s and 1950s.
That's interesting because I mean, you're getting at the distinction you make in your book between the first generation of conservative media and kind of media slash activists and the second generation, which you say kind of picks up with Limbaugh and the more entertainment driven, popular, financially successful. That's one of the things you point out, too, is that like Rush Limbaugh was far more financially successful than National Review ever was, which probably lost money most years. Right.
I think National Review had 1 year in the black.
Yeah, I think in your book, Nikki, you say it might have been like 1993 or 1994, something like that.
Yeah,
right?
It was in
like
the 90s.
Early 90s. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, in some ways, a lot of the conversation we've had so far has focused a lot on the continuities on the right. But because I found the distinctions you draw in your book so interesting, could you elaborate that distinction between the first and second generation? Maybe you got at it just a moment ago, but I'm especially interested in the way you indicate that the popularity and financial success and accessibility of the second generation of conservative media, kind of that's what lent it some of its power. So what was the first generation, the Bill Buckleys, the National Reviews, the Bill Rushers that you talk about, kind of what was different about their relationship to political power in the Republican Party, kind of in that first generation of media activism?
So I would say that that first generation, it was full of people who had a lot of social and economic and political capital in a way.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Like Bill Buckley was wealthy. Clarence Mannion, who I mentioned earlier, was the dean of Notre Dame Law School. I mean, these were not people who were, you know, outsiders down in their luck, but they were people who felt like they were outsiders. And they were political activists first and foremost, who were like, how am I going to get my message out? I'll start a magazine. I'll start a publishing company. I'll start a radio station. But they didn't necessarily have the skill set that one would need to make that work. I mean, they make it work.
Right.
National Review is still around. Mannion's on air for like 25 years. But it's not exciting. The Mannions show is on for 15 minutes once a week. So it also doesn't have that kind of all-encompassing kind of wall-to-wall media environment that we would become familiar with in
right.
the 1990s. And nobody's making any money off of it. Nobody is getting rich off of doing this. I mean, they have jobs. And because they're so well connected, they're not hurting in any way. But the media enterprises themselves are not profitable. And so it really is a change when you get to Rush Limbaugh and to Fox News. Rush Limbaugh, I mean, in 2008, he signed a new contract for 8 years and $400 million. Like, we're talking... Wow. Obscene amounts of money here. Fox News obviously is a multi-billion dollar enterprise, and all that introduces other incentives. I mean, for somebody like Bill Buckley or Clarence Mannion, their goal is to try to get conservatives political power. That's really important to them. It drives a lot of their projects. But they don't have to worry about all these other incentives. For somebody like Rush Limbaugh, he's very upfront about the fact that the thing that he was in it for was money. And if people asked him, well, do you want Republicans to win? He's like, money. Money, money, right. money, money. That's right. why I'm here. That's a little different with Fox News. Like, Roger Ailes is very much somebody who was hell-bent on changing politics in America, and Rupert Murdoch as well. But, you know, again, there are a lot of different incentives. You don't want to lose too many advertisers. You have to protect the ability to make money. You have to protect your positioning with the Republican Party. I mean, one interesting place where you see ideology isn't really driving things. In 2013, Marco Rubio starts making the rounds and trying to convince conservative media hosts not to attack his immigration plan. It kind of works. Like, he goes to Rush Limbaugh, he's like, don't attack my plan. And Rush Limbaugh's like, okay, I won't attack your plan. He goes to Rupert Murdoch. And so you have a couple of weeks there where Sean Hannity is like, this is a good bill. We should support it. It's not amnesty. And he gets so much blowback from his base immediately that, like, a week yeah. later, he's on TV with, like, banners that say amnesty coming to America.
Yeah. And it seems like you can correct me on this. I might be wrong. But someone like Bill Buckley, because he was wealthy, because he was a New York socialite, because he was a Yale guy, right? Like, a part of the elite by birth, almost. It seems like some of the way he tried to wield political power would be, like, he knew Richard Nixon, right? And so mm-hmm. he would talk to Nixon. Or he was friends with Ronald Reagan. And so he would, you know, Bill and Pat would fly out to California and visit Nancy and Ronnie, you know? And, like it seemed like a more personal network of relationships than, like, a media behemoth who wields power in that way.
Yeah, and that's exactly right about Buckley. He ran in elite circles, and he was respected in elite circles. He had sort of a cultural cachet even among non-conservatives. What's interesting, especially you see this in the Trump administration, is that as conservative media becomes more of the communications arm of the Republican Party, really carrying out the communications functions of the conservative movement, you start to see those relationships emerge again, in part because so many people who work in Republican administrations have come through conservative media.
Right.
But for somebody like Donald Trump, as we know, he was talking to Sean Hannity after Hannity's show every night. He was talking to people like Rush Limbaugh. He was using them as, like, an informal cabinet who he was always talking to. So those relationships come back during the Trump era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's one other feature of the second generation, or the context in which the second generation arose of conservative media, that you get at in your book that I just want to ask you one question about, which is, you point out that by the time, you know, Reagan takes office and the second generation of media starts to appear in the 80s, mid to late 80s, there also at that point was a whole conservative infrastructure of, like, think tanks and policy shops, the Heritage Foundation, AEI, Cato Institute. You can go down the list. And so the conservative movement as a whole had been built up institutionally, you might say. How did the new conservative media, the Limbaughs and Hannitys, how do they relate to, like, that part of the conservative movement's infrastructure, you might put it?
Yeah, I think that they're intimately related. I think that's absolutely a very important difference between the two. The conservative movement is just so much bigger, and it's had by 1988 a real taste of power, which is important as well. Like, there's an idea that if you write a white paper at the Cato Institute, that it could actually translate into policy somewhere down the road. Yeah. So you're not just a voice crying out in the wilderness. Right. I think they saw themselves as part of the same project. And so Rush Limbaugh would be sent notes from the Heritage Foundation, and he would reference, you know, kind of the top lines of some of their reports and some of their policies. And when I was talking earlier about that network of authorities, now you have a whole think tank industry that can give you a bunch of numbers to back up the arguments. Right? There are graphs that you can, and Rush Limbaugh could put in his daily stack of stuff, which were the references that he would put online for the things he talked about that day, kind of like the newsletters we know now, or the show notes, I guess you would say. So I think that that was an important part of building up the authorities that Limbaugh talked about, and also like bringing some cohesion in a way to the conservative movement. Limbaugh was intimately familiar, particularly with the Heritage Foundation, but also with Cato and AEI, and so are a lot of other media figures that come up. They see themselves as, again, as part of the same project. And so, yeah, the boat is all rowing in the same direction, at least for a good chunk of time there.
It strikes me, and you've sort of alluded to this, that in some ways, and I kind of suggested this earlier too, but in some ways, Trump is the test case of whether you can just merge conservative entertainment and conservative movement politics entirely, just make them coterminous and see whether you can still win and whether you can still accomplish political goals for the party. But it seems like Trump, unlike previous political figures on the right, he wasn't really worried about political outcomes as much as he was worried about how they would play on conservative media. And that potentially had less success in terms of conservative policy victories in some way, but it seems to have been entirely successful in winning a durable, loyal base for him in particular. It seems like in all the ways in which we say that Trump sort of called the bluff of the conservative movement, in the sense, as we talk about in the podcast a lot, that he called the bluff on racial politics. You know, he's just a racist. He called the bluff on nativism. You know, we're just fully nativist. We're nationalist. We're America first. He called the bluff in so many different ways. Like, we're not going to do all this niceties about our resentments. We're just going to say them out loud. But it seems like he also called the bluff of what is holding this coalition together? Who's doing the work to create a Republican base that's activated and excited about being involved in politics, or at least involved in voting? It's the entertainment industry. And he didn't pretend like it was otherwise. And, you know, in that way, he really is the apotheosis of the thing that Limbaugh set in motion. I wonder if you think that's right, and what that, if it is, or if it's not exactly right, what it means for Republican politics going forward.
Well, I think it is largely right. I mean, Trump was focused on winning news cycles, which was something that was very different from actually passing policies, which he, you know, obviously he did a ton of change and a ton of damage, whether it's through the Supreme Court or whether it's through deregulation or whether it's through those massive tax cuts or whether it's the way that he handled the COVID pandemic. So I don't want to pretend that there weren't actual policy consequences. But, you know, he called the bluff on a lot of things, including on Paul Ryan's Republican Party.
Right.
And it was so interesting to watch, because he was winning the news cycles and because he was providing the entertainment, conservatives looked around and they were like, yeah, maybe I don't actually care that much about free trade.
Yeah,
I don't actually care that much about monetary policy.
This is too much fun.
Exactly. And you would hear Rush Limbaugh. I mean, Limbaugh in his final days, I think you've heard this on some of the other programs as well. He's like, look, actually, deficits don't matter. He's pulling a full Cheney at this point, where he's just like, deficits don't matter. Wow. Look, it doesn't seem to be driving inflation. That doesn't seem to be happening like we predicted. So I'm not going to get all bent out of shape over all of these trillion-dollar bills that are being passed. And of course, that's going to snap back in place now that there's a Democratic president. But that, I think, is such the entertainment value really superseded most of the purported ideological content of conservatism. And I say purported because, you know, I'm talking about kind of like the Reformicon movement of 2013 or the 2012 autopsy and that particular vision of conservatism. I think every single piece of that was tossed out by the Trump administration, and he won far more votes than Reformicons. And I don't know how durable his coalition actually is going to be, because so far it seems like the only thing that holds it together is Donald Trump.
Right.
And it's hard to know who, if anyone, is going to be able to replicate that, precisely because of what you said. I mean, the people who are vying to be the next Trump are all politicians.
The important thing is whether they can hold people's interest on, you know, on TV and on radio.
Or on Twitter, if they're allowed on it. Or on Parler, if that's where they all migrate. yeah. And so what does Republican politics and conservative politics look like going forward? I think it's a huge question mark. And, you know, Limbaugh's death, just as Donald Trump was leaving office, accentuates that as well. I mean, I think we don't entirely know what the future of conservative media is going to look like. And when we're uncertain about the fate of conservative media, we should be uncertain about the fate of conservative politics, because they are at this point inseparable.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, there was something just so fitting about a president who seemed to experience his presidency as it was reflected back to him on television, being the kind of apotheosis of the story your book tells over the last, well, you know, from the mid-20th century forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Trump was a fitting end to all of that really unexpected ways, I think. I mean, as somebody who was steeped in all of this for years before Trump showed up on the scene, it obviously like reset a lot of my understandings of conservatism as well, even though I was intimately familiar with the interplay between political entertainment and conservative politics. But the board got shaken up pretty rapidly in 2015, 2016. And I think it's been good to sort of come to terms with some of the underlying, the real stuff of conservatism as it's been exposed during the Trump era.
Right. It strikes me that you're in a slightly better position for having understood how important media and entertainment has been to the movement for the extent of its history. But of course, you were in the same position as the rest of us in some ways, thinking like, well, this movement still has some kind of intellectual underpinnings that inform the sorts of things that it aspires to do. And maybe a figure who is purely a celebrity and purely a creature of entertainment won't, you know, run the board as he did.
Well, that's why I'm writing my second book, so I can come to terms with all of that.
We're so excited for your second book.
Well, can you tell us what it's about? We've alluded to it.
Sure, sure. So it looks at conservatism in the post-Reagan era, and it traces the rise of a media-driven politics that sheds a lot of the primary features of Reaganism, from the optimism to the pragmatism to the sort of cold warrior conservatism to, you know, during the Reagan years. We can talk about how soft or how hard his embrace of democracy was, but he talked about democracy a lot, in part of because of democracy promotion abroad, but also because he won two huge landslides and democracy seemed to be working out pretty well for him.
Yeah.
So I also look at how the conservative movement abandoned majoritarian politics and began to embrace minoritarian politics. All of that as I look at the conservatism of the 1990s.
That's really fascinating. We will have to have you back on to talk about that book. For listeners, one more time, Nicole Hemmer, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. That's your book that can be bought and read now, and we encourage listeners to do that. And a lot of the stuff we talked about here, you go into even more detail in the book. And I just really, I love the book. So listeners, please pick it up. And thank you, Nicole, for such a lovely conversation. This was really terrific.
Thank you so much for having me. I have so much fun. I'm so glad that I finally got a chance to do this.
Yeah, we are too.
Thanks a lot, Nikki. This was so fun and so excellent. Thank you.